just want to say here before my sermon that in the constellation of my growing up here in USG, and I think my generation of children growing up, Kathy Bonanno was a bright, shining star. So I just want you to know that I hold tenderly her memory with you all this morning and hold tenderly the grief and heartache of this USG community at this time. So I first heard the first hymn we sang this morning, which is not always every music director's favorite, right, Mark? Mark did alert that to me as soon as I walked in today. Which I know, but I chose the hymn because it comes with this story. So the hymn speaks of wandering, and on a June afternoon a few years ago in a conference center at UU General Assembly, during an epic technological failure, this is when I first heard this hymn. So the ministers and staff of one of our sister congregations, who I shall not name, had been recognized at that General Assembly for their congregation's like amazing ministry and their rapid growth, and they were leading this workshop to present on their myriad successes in congregational life. And as about 100 of us sat dutifully in those conference center hard row chairs awaiting their wisdom, the beautiful video that they had so professionally prepared for this moment failed to launch. Okay, so it failed to launch. They're like, no problem. This will just take a second. We'll reboot. Oh, no. We rebooted, and it's still not working. So then they turned to us and said, why don't you guys just talk amongst yourselves, as they all circled around the laptop, frantically typing on it. And this sort of worried titter went out through the rows of people. But, you know, we were good UU sports, so we turned to our newfound neighbors and we started to chat. But as the minutes kept ticking by and the hour of the hour-long workshops kept getting eaten into, the nervous tension in the room started mounting. Have you ever been in a room where you can just feel that nervous tension? And just when it began to seem unbearable and that people would start to leave and go find another workshop, one of the presenters stepped away from the laptop. She stepped away from the laptop and she stepped back and she looked out at all of us and she just began to sing, we are going, heaven knows where we are going, but we know within and we'll get there. Heaven knows how we will get there. But we know we will. Whoa, ya, ya. Whoa, ya, ya. Okay, you get the point. It was like this collective sigh just came over the room, and we started singing, and the tension was released. And it still took a few more minutes to get the video up and running, but finally, our friends were able to get their video to launch, and there were no defections from the room. And I made a mental note and thought, all right, whenever in a situation like this, just sing wo ya ya. So the dictionary describes anxiety as a feeling of worry, nervousness, or unease, typically about an uncertain outcome. Anxiety can strike any time there is a question about how something might turn out, which, if you really stop to think about it, is, and I don't want to dwell here too long, all the time, right? This is life, not being certain how it's all going to turn out. And some of us, we know, are more prone to anxiety than others. Some of us live with it and manage it every day with all the tools we can muster. But all of us, if we are alive and if we are human beings, will experience it. And I don't think it really matters how weighty the circumstances are surrounding it. Anxiety can surface when the outcome in question is, in the grand scheme of things, pretty low stakes, like, is the video going to play at the one-hour workshop? Or it can surface, too, when, as of late, in our faith, in our UU faith and in our world, it feels like the stakes couldn't be higher. Now, "Whoa, ya, ya," in those lovely lyrics, assures us, perhaps a little too confidently to reflect our current mood in this world, that we will get there. We will get where? The promised land, the land of milk and honey, the 2020 election? I don't know. You tell me what your definition is of the promised land. I'm thinking we're thinking sooner here. As you use, we might quote Parker and then King, the end of the moral arc of the universe, which still seems an awfully long way off. For the time being, to me, it feels that we are not really at the end of that song, but stuck somewhere in the middle verse before its happy ending, the part where it's hard, we know, and the road is, I'm a little out of key here, muddy and rough, muddy and rough. With every day's news cycle, with every hour's new tweet, we sense in our collective consciousness this rocky terrain we are in. We feel the rockiness in the spiking hate crimes in our country, in the threats against members of marginalized communities. We feel it in yet more horrific gun violence. We feel it in newly uncovered evidence of obstructed justice and democracy itself being threatened. Not to mention, we feel it in the ongoing struggles for justice that predated the new administration in Washington, but that have certainly not been improved by it. The deportation of hundreds of our undocumented brothers and sisters, and yet one more acquittal for the murder of a man of color in our country, the hands of law enforcement this week. These are anxious and hard times we are living in. And they are hard for all of us who are living them. But according to Susan Beaumont, who is an observer of congregational life, Susan says these times are especially bad for leaders. I think we can see that if we want to ask any of our leaders how they're feeling. In an article she wrote last winter, she argued that leadership is not defined by knowledge or charisma, but rather an ability to remain non-reactive, thoughtful, and steady when things around us seem to be spinning out of control. True leadership, she reminds us, is the capacity to stay calm in the midst of profound anxiety. When we are in a deeply grounded place, she writes, we are capable of extraordinary and powerful leadership. Now, I'm wondering, can you think of an example of grounded, calm, powerful leadership? Just think for a moment, right? In a really small case, I can think of my colleague in that workshop when everyone was sweating and getting stressed, thinking, I will sing "Whoa, Ya, Ya," and calm the mood in here. That was present and non-anxious leadership. But there are even more poignant cases I can think of. I imagine a picture I saw last winter of the water protectors in Standing Rock, just standing there in the face of provocation, of water hoses, of violence. As Susan writes, it is one thing to describe this kind of leadership presence, but embodying it is a different matter. How do we offer a non-anxious, grounded, calm leadership presence when we ourselves feel shaken to the core? Now, maybe you were thinking, that sounds like a really interesting article, Mara, and that's so insightful, but it's a really good thing that I'm not a leader in times like these. What a relief that I don't need to worry about being one of those non-anxious presences. Phew. Anyone thinking? I'm glad to be. Yes, you are good. Yeah, I like an honest person in the pew. You're thinking, I'm so glad I wasn't a senator at that committee hearing this week. But hold on. Because I think that whether or not you consider yourself to be a leader, whether or not you have an official, quote-unquote, role of any sort, whether you serve on the board of an organization or whether you're a ministerial intern like Connie or whether you chair a committee here at the Unitarian Society of Germantown or whether you are elected to public office, I think each of us is capable of leading. And what I want to tell you is that in times like this, we all need to be leading. As tribal elder Chief Looking Horse wrote last winter about Standing Rock, it is time that all of us become leaders to help protect the sacred upon this Mother Earth. So I'm looking at you all, my fellow leaders. Who here is willing to be a fellow leader? Would you just like... I'm hoping to see all hands coming up. Yes, yes, amen. Okay. Some of you are like, no, we'll see. This is what I love about a UU congregation is like, we're not going to just follow what you're saying blindly here. So just stay with me here till the end. So my premise is that we are all needing to lead, but how do we do this? How do we lead when all we feel in the quietness of our own tender heart is scared or sad or really pissed off or just brokenhearted? How do we lead? How do we remain grounded when we are gripped by all those feelings? How do we move beyond that when what we feel just resonating through us is the paralyzing uncertainty of this world? These are questions I have been wrestling with all year, and they're questions that Susan Beaumont speaks into in this piece that I mentioned. So she proposes something about leadership and anxiety, which to me seems a little unexpected, but that rings true. So when you search and look up anxiety, you find there its antonym. And I'm wondering if you can help me here. What do you think of as the opposite of anxiety? Calm. Serenity. Okay, right. But Susan said that the antidote to anxiety is not the same thing as its antonym. That if we want to alleviate that feeling of anxiousness, we need something else. And this is what she says it is. Wonder. Wonder is the antidote to anxiety. Susan writes, "We cannot be filled with wonder and remain anxious at the same time." She writes, wonder is the ability to feel amazement, admiration, and curiosity about something. Wonder invites our best, most creative thinking. Wonder is what connects us with God. And I wonder, as I think of Susan's words, isn't that what Nelson Bryant was saying in our reading? Isn't that what he was trying to remind us in those words he wrote to his young son, many years ago now? Marvel at the sun, rejoice in the wheeling of stars, learn their names, slide down the wind with a hawk, cherish the smell of the wood smoke. Those words touched me when I first heard them, and I think the reason they touch deep is that each of us in our being knows that sense of wonder. We may feel an increased inclination to wonder too at this time of year, maybe not the humidity. That might not inspire us to wonder, but still these lengthening days, the sun's warmth, the longer span of daylight, the blooming, blossoming, refulgent season. I know when I came through the garden this morning, the long green and the blooming bushes, I felt that sense of wonder stirring in me. But I also think the words of Bryant's touch us because chances are we have also experienced that other thing he writes of, which is that the thieves of wonder can enter any heart. The thieves of wonder can enter any heart. Let's just sit with that for a moment, the thieves of wonder. So about a decade ago, a Washington Post reporter named Jean Weingarten created an experiment which speaks to me of the thieves of wonder and the challenge of retaining wonder. Some of you might have heard or read this story, and as I tell it to you, it might start ringing a bell. And I'm going to tell you this story by excerpting a sermon that a dear friend of mine, Claire Feingold Thorne, wrote, because I love her telling of the story. So Jean Weingarten, a handful of years ago now, asked the classical violinist Joshua Bell to play for an hour during morning rush hour at a major commuter subway stop in Washington, D.C. Is this now starting to ring a bell? Yes, okay. So we're gonna hear it again. So Bell was not an ordinary violinist. He was a child prodigy. He sells out concert halls, and apparently the going rate for his performances is something like $1,000 a minute. Doesn't that sound like a good going rate for your services? One magazine wrote that his playing, quote, does nothing less than tell human beings why they bother to live. So, okay, just keep that in mind about Joshua Bell. So here is Weingarten's experiment. Here's what he writes. The fiddler is standing against a bare wall outside the metro in an indoor arcade at the top of escalators, and he was one of the finest classical musicians in the world, playing some of the most elegant music ever written on one of the world's most valuable violins ever made. His performance was arranged by the Washington Post as an experiment in context and priorities with this question. In a banal setting at an inconvenient time, would beauty and wonder transcend? My friend Claire writes of this. To find this beauty, all the commuters had to do was claim it. In fact, Weingarten was worried that such a large crowd might gather that it would terribly disrupt traffic that morning, that Bell would be recognized, that security guards would be needed to arrive and, like, stop the herds that were thronging around him. So on the day of the experiment, Bell came to the station and he put down his case and he put a few starter dollars in it and he began to play. He played for 45 minutes, during which about 1,100 people passed by. Of those 1,100 people, seven people stopped. Seven people stopped and listened for at least a minute. 27 people gave money, which added up to $32.17. Jean Weingarten wrote of this, "You can play the recording once or 15 times, and it never gets any easier to watch. Try speeding it up, and it becomes one of those herky-jerky silent newsreels. The people scurry by in comical little hops and starts, cups of coffee in their hands, cell phones at their ears, ID tags slapping at their chests, a grim dance of indifference, inertia, and the dingy gray rush of modernity." My friend Claire writes about this. The story makes many people wonder what they would have done stepping off the escalator there at L'Enfant Plaza to the sounds of Joshua Bell. The commuters that morning passed expected beauty, but are they really so awful? Would any of us have been any different? Optimal is not 8 a.m., late to work shoes tight, meeting to get to, project to finish by the end of the day. And the philosopher Kant once said that for a human to recognize beauty, the viewing conditions have to be optimal. In his article about this, Weingarten noted that there was no demographic pattern to distinguish the people who stayed, the seven who stopped for more than a minute, the 20-something who gave money. But there was one thing that stood out that was absolutely consistent. Every single time a child walked by, they tried to stop and listen. And every single time a parent scooted that kid away. Nelson Bryant writes, "Once there was a boy who beheld the earth with a wonder much like yours. Each dawn was a promise, each season a delight, and the world, for all its anguish, was good to know." Every time I hear that story, I think, oh, how easily I could have been that parent. How recently I probably was that parent, as recently as like 2 hours ago, before I got here this morning. One of my little people is here and might be able to attest to that later if you ask him. And not only that, but how easily I could have been the harried commuter, coffee cup in hand, head down, hastening on. You know, I wasn't there that morning when Joshua Bell played, but a few years earlier, I did pass through that station, that very station, every morning to my stop that was just one ahead in that morning rush. That was the winter of 2002, and I was working as a staffer for a member of Congress who at the time was actively working to stop the invasion of Iraq, which, my goodness, feels like a long time ago now, doesn't it? So much has happened since then. But I remember palpably in my being the feelings of that December, which was, I think, like the current time, a time of great anxiety with no small measure of foreboding. And in my little work world, our collective anxiety was high. And my fellow staff members, we were swimming in it. And these were days, this was December, I would arrive at work before the sun came up, and I would leave well after dark. Most days I would just hurry out with that cell phone on my ear, or looking at the pavement, rushing to get to the metro so I could just get home and be done with it. But I remember one night where, for some reason, and I'm not sure why, I hurtled out of my office, and instead of looking down or at my phone, I found my gaze drawing up, and I looked up, and there, in spite of everything, were the stars. The poet writes, "Like a stunned piano, like a bucket of fresh milk flung into the air, like a bride stepping down from the altar with dozens of fists of confetti thrown, the stars surprise the sky." That little experiment from Gene Weingarten makes it clear just how easy it is in the pace of our days, amid the seeming urgency all around us, the rush to get to the next thing, the rush to do our work, how easy it is to lose track with our innate capacity to wonder at the world. And it is that capacity we need so much now. But I take heart from his essay, too, and from Edward Hirsch, the poet who gave us those words, that even if we lose track of our wonder, even if we forget what it feels like for a moment to appreciate and savor and be awestruck at our world, wonder is never far from our grasp. We may tend to miss the marvelous right in front of us, but the wondrousness of this world will always beckon us back. It will tug on our hand to stop and listen to the extraordinary music. It will bring us back and beckon to us that if we only happen to glance up from time to time, we will see there, for the price of no admission, in spite of everything, the stars. This June of 2017, this summer, this season of great uncertainty, this rough and muddy road we find ourselves on, may we find in the midst of it and hold on to our wonder. May it be how we start and end our days. May it be our grounding principle and our guiding star, not as a distraction from the world and its heartache, but as perhaps the very thing that will allow us to answer it with great care, with a calm and determined presence, and an earth-moving power. Let us wonder as we wander out under the sky. May it be so now and in the days to come.